The response of the government to such signs of desperation, anger, and alienation has been historically quite predictable. Build more jails, lock up more people, execute more prisoners, and continue with the same policies that produced the desperation. And so, by the end of the Clinton administration, the United States had more of its population in prison per capita, a total of 2 million people, than any other country in the world, with a possible exception of China. Clinton claimed to be moderating his policies to match public opinion, but opinion surveys in the 80s and early 90s indicated that Americans favored bold policies that neither Democrats nor Republicans were willing to put forward. Universal free health care, guaranteed employment, government help for the poor and homeless, with taxes on the rich and cuts in the military budget to pay for social programs. The gap between national policy and the feelings of the American public suggested that another scenario was possible, one that envisioned in the new millennium citizens organizing to demand what the Declaration of Independence promised, a government that protected the equal right of everyone to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. This meant economic arrangements that distributed the national wealth rationally and humanely. This meant a culture where the young no longer were taught to strive for success as a mask for greed. Throughout the 90s, while conservative Republicans and moderate Democrats were running the government, there were large numbers of American citizens unrepresented in Washington, unreported in the press, who were protesting government policy in various ways and demanding a more just and peaceful society. The signs of citizen energy outside the circles of power in Washington were not given much attention in the national media, except when a phenomenon was too big to ignore. Even a gathering of 500,000 adults and children of all colors arriving in the nation's capital to stand for children was paid little or no attention by television and newspapers. But the signs of defiance and resistance were many and varied. In Minneapolis, there was a continuing campaign against a corporation that manufactured landmines. An ex-GI who had been mutilated by an American landmine came to Minneapolis to join the campaign, joined by a young woman who was traveling all over the world to tell people about the children dying on all continents as a result of millions of landmines planted by the United States and other nations. Four nuns, the McDonald sisters, who were indeed sisters, participated in the protest and were arrested. In 1994 in Los Angeles, in opposition to a new California law that took away basic health and educational rights from the children of illegal immigrants, a quarter of a million people took to the streets in protest. When the United States made clear its intention to drop bombs on Iraq, presumably because Iraq was not allowing inspection of what American officials called weapons of mass destruction, Secretary of State Madeleine Albright and other officials spoke to a town meeting in Columbus, Ohio, to build up public support for the bombing. But the planned scenario was interrupted by a young man who, despite plans to control all questions, managed to get the floor and ask Madeleine Albright about all the other nations, allies of the United States, that possessed weapons of mass destruction. The Secretary of State was obviously taken by surprise and stumbled through an answer, which a national TV audience could plainly see. Plans for the bombing were quickly postponed, though sometime later, the regular bombing of Iraq, of which the press took no notice, resumed. When Madeleine Albright was given an honorary degree by the University of California at Berkeley in the year 2000, there were protests in the audience and a huge banner, "Madeleine Albright is a war criminal." Protesters and the banner were removed from the theater. It happened that the student selected to receive the university's prestigious university medal and to give the student address at commencement was a young Palestinian woman named Fadia Rafidi. She was moved to the end of the program so that Albright could speak and leave, but she was determined to speak to Albright's defense of the U.S. sanctions against Iraq. She spoke of the medical supplies not allowed into Iraq, about the hundreds of thousands of deaths of children as a result of the sanctions. She agreed that Saddam Hussein was a brutal dictator, but she said, "When he was gassing the Kurds, he was gassing them using chemical weapons that were manufactured in Rochester, New York. And when he was fighting a long and protracted war with Iran, where 1 million people died, it was the CIA that was funding him. It was U.S. policy that built this dictator. When they didn't need him, they started imposing sanctions on his people. Sanctions should be directed at people's governments, not at the people." In 1998, 7,000 people from all over the country traveled to Fort Benning, Georgia, to protest the existence of the School of the Americas, whose graduates, trained by the United States, had participated in atrocities in various Latin American countries. They carried 8 caskets representing the 6 priests, a cook, and a young girl who had been assassinated by military men invading their home. Ironically, the Georgia federal judge who sentenced them to prison terms, Robert J. Elliott, was the same judge who had pardoned Lieutenant William Calley, found guilty of the My Lai massacre of villagers in Vietnam. On the anniversary of the bombing of Nagasaki in August 1999, 8 pacifists decided to block 4 lanes of traffic leading to a nuclear submarine base in Bangor, Maine. At that base, 8 Trident submarines were housed, carrying over 1,000 nuclear warheads. The protesters were arrested. They managed to explain to the jury, however, the reason for their opposition to nuclear weapons, and they were acquitted. The woman who headed the jury said later, "I am proud to sit with these people." The culture had been affected by the movements of the 60s in a way that could not be obliterated. There was an unmistakable, stubborn new consciousness manifested from time to time in the cinema, on television, in the world of music, an awareness that women deserved equal rights, that the sexual preferences of men and women were their own affair, that the growing gap between rich and poor gave the lie to the word democracy. Racism was still deeply embedded in American society. The evidence was in continued police brutality against people of color, in the higher rates of infant mortality in the black population, the lack of jobs for young blacks, and the corresponding growth of crime and imprisonment. But the country was becoming more diverse, more Latino people, more Asians, more interracial marriages. It was projected that by the year 2050, people of color would be equal in number to whites in the United States. There were sporadic attempts to organize the discontent among the nation's African Americans. In the late 80s, there had been a hint of a future possibility, as the black leader Jesse Jackson, speaking for the poor and dispossessed of all colors, a rainbow coalition, won millions of votes in the presidential primary and gave the nation a brief, rare surge of political excitement. In 1995, 1 million men traveled from all over the country to Washington, D.C., the Million Man March, to declare to the nation's leaders that they intended to become a force for change. The march did not have a clear agenda, but it was an expression of solidarity. In the summer of 1998, 2,000 African-American men and women met in Chicago to found the Black Radical Congress. The following year, the West Coast Longshoremen's Union carried out an 8-hour work stoppage in protest against the incarceration and death sentence of Mumia Abu-Jamal. Jamal was a respected black journalist who had been tried and sentenced under circumstances that suggested his race and his radicalism, as well as his persistent criticism of the Philadelphia police, were the reasons he now sat on death row. The labor movement in the 90s was showing signs of a new energy. This despite the gradual decline in union membership as manufacturing plants moved out of the country and industrial workers were being outnumbered by service and white-collar workers who were more difficult to organize. There was an impetus for a new militancy, as it became clear that the wealth of the nation was going mostly to the very rich, and the gap between rich and poor was growing. In the 90s, the income of the richest 5% of the population grew by 20%, while the income of the poor and middle class, taking into consideration the rise in cost of living, either fell or remained the same. In 1990, the average pay of the chief executive officers of the 500 largest corporations was 84 times that of the average worker. By 1999, it was 475 times the average worker's pay. A new president of the AFL-CIO, John Sweeney, coming out of the Service Employees International Union, a sign of the change in the labor force, appeared to depart sharply from the conservatism of his predecessors. He encouraged the idea of a union summer, inspired by the Freedom Summer in Mississippi in 1964, tapping the idealism of young people by inviting them to help in the organizing of the new service workers, white-collar workers, farm workers, immigrant workers. The unions were losing some strikes, as in the long, bitter struggles in the 90s in Decatur, Illinois, against three corporate giants, Caterpillar, Firestone, and Staley. But there were also victories. United Parcel Service workers went on strike for 15 days, a strike that brought great national attention and won their demand that part-time jobs without health and other benefits should be converted to 10,000 full-time jobs with benefits. The Machinists Union won strikes at the Boeing Company and McDonnell Douglas. Hotel workers won strikes in Minneapolis and San Francisco. Cleaning women, mostly immigrants, were victorious in Los Angeles, striking against owners of skyscrapers, where the poorly paid workers clean the offices of the city's most prosperous business people. In the year 2000, the biggest white-collar strike in the nation's history was won for 19,000 engineers and professional workers of Boeing, who succeeded in having their salaries match those of workers in other Boeing plants.